synthetic opioids causing overdoses nationwide. And we're going to look at two high-impact nurse leadership programs affecting patient outcomes for critical care patients. If that's what you're looking for, you found it. It's The Nursing Show. Well, good day and welcome to this week's episode of The Nursing Show, the podcast for nurses by nurses. I'm your host, Jamie Davis, and I'd like to take this opportunity to thank all of you for checking out our program this week. We've got a pretty good show for you coming up. First up in this week's nursing news items, we have a special alert segment from our good friend Lisa Booz from the Maryland Poison Center. She's talking about current issues being seen with synthetic opioids. Then in this week's tip segment from the NTI 2016 AACN Critical Care Nurses Conference in New Orleans last month, I have two interviews I did with their Clinical Scene Investigator Leadership Program nurses. First, I have clinical impact nurse Nancy De La Salle on her program to get ventilated patients mobilized earlier in critical care settings. Then I bring you Laura Mills. She has a catheter-associated UTI Hawks program, which had a significant effect on reducing these types of infections in her facility. So check them out coming up in the news segment. Before we get to the news and everything else, though, I do want to make sure you're doing a couple of things. You need to follow up on what we talk about in the show this here at The Nursing Show, and you can do that by going over to nursingshow.com. There's a show notes link at the top of the page. You can also look at the other articles and other things there. There's a link to our free mobile app, lots of other stuff. But I want you to make sure you're following up on what I talk about in the show each week so you understand how it's applied using your own nursing scope of practice. If you check into that stuff and you still want to get in touch with me, I hope you'll do so. Just drop me an email to nursingshow@gmail.com. I love to hear from you, and I respond back to every email that comes in. So send me links to news items you want me to cover. Maybe you have an idea for a topic for a future episode or an interview suggestion with you or somebody you know. Whatever the case may be, please keep those emails coming. Also, a special thank you to Physiocontrol for being my overall NTIAACN conference sponsor, as well as NESI by Blickman for being my mobility and travel sponsor, and Advanced Ultraviolet Systems for being my infection prevention and control sponsors at NTI in New Orleans. Check out my links to all of them in the show notes for this episode. That's it. I'll have some more contact information coming up later on in this episode, but let's go ahead and get on into this week's news items. They're coming right up. You know, it's not a surprise that we have a heroin epidemic in the United States right now. In 2014, there were 10,000 overdose deaths related to heroin, 26% more than in 2013. So what's become apparent is that many of the heroin overdoses and deaths we're seeing are not just due to heroin. Fentanyl and fentanyl analogs are being added to heroin, usually without the buyer's knowledge. So check out this special segment I have with Lisa Booz, a pharmacist from the Maryland Poison Center. She talks with us about this important problem that they're seeing coming up in their phone lines over at the Poison Center. Hi, Lisa. Welcome back to the show. It's been a while since we've had you on, but we've got a lot of things going on recently and some hot topics in the news to talk about.
We actually do. There's been a lot that's been going on, particularly in the field of drug abuse and all the drugs that are out there now that people have access to. So I wanted to update people on what we're seeing as far as poison centers and emergency departments so that you can be familiar with them.
So let's jump in and talk about this. I think we're going to be talking about opioid abuse and some of the things that have been going on. There's some really frightening happenings that have caused some major issues with overdoses and patients in the emergency field.
Yeah, there really are. Now, we all know that there's been a heroin epidemic. You know, I don't think that's a surprise at all. That there's a heroin epidemic in the United States, and just to put that a little bit into perspective, in 2014 there were over 10,500 overdose deaths related to heroin, and that was 26% more than what we saw in 2013. But what's changed and what's become apparent is that many of the heroin overdoses and deaths that we're seeing now are not just due to heroin. Fentanyl and fentanyl analogs are being added to heroin, usually without the buyer having any knowledge of it. It's being added usually to increase potency. The fentanyl's also been detected in tablets that have been disguised as prescription drugs. So it's in tablets that look like Norco, which is a hydrocodone and acetaminophen product, and in tablets that look like Xanax, which is alprazolam, and that's a benzodiazepine, but it's actually fentanyl. Fentanyl is 50 to 100 times more potent than morphine and 25 to 50 times more potent than heroin. Because it's so much more potent, small amounts can lead very easily to overdoses. In Maryland, here in my state, the number of overdose deaths that involved non-pharmaceutical fentanyl climbed almost 320% from 2013 to 2014. There are also fentanyl analogs and other synthetic opioids that are either added to heroin or sometimes they're purchased knowingly on the internet to be used as heroin substitutes, either because they produce euphoria or sometimes people will buy them to self-treat their opioid withdrawal. When they're sold over the internet, they're usually disguised as research chemicals. So that's what it will say on the internet site. Synthetic opioids can be used orally, parenterally, rectally, by nasal insufflation, or by heating the drug and inhaling the vapor. Most of the synthetic opioids are sought after because they're more potent than heroin, but really, in most cases, we don't know a lot about these drugs. We don't know their actual potency. We don't know their kinetics, so how long they their effects last or when they start, or the effects that the patient might have from these drugs. Acetylfentanyl is a fentanyl analog that's not as potent as fentanyl, but nevertheless, it's still been a contributing factor in a number of overdoses and fatalities in heroin users. 3-methylfentanyl is another analog that's been involved in overdoses. And more recently, furanylfentanyl has been a drug that's been showing up in overdoses and also drug seizures by law enforcement agencies. It's thought that manufacturers, which usually are in China, are making this furanylfentanyl to try to avoid some of the laws that we currently have that have been passed against specific drugs. Now, here's a case that was called into the Maryland Poison Center, and this involved another fentanyl analog. So this is a 27-year-old man that had a history of heroin abuse, and he was found unresponsive and not breathing in bed. Next to him were 3 small bags containing a white powder, and they were labeled 100 milligrams PFBF. There was no response to 2 milligrams of naloxone given intranasally by EMS, but he did wake up and he became agitated after a second 2 milligram dose of naloxone was given in the emergency department. Once he woke up, he admitted to purchasing PFBF online and snorting it for its heroin-like effects. PFBF is a fentanyl analog, and it is sold as a powder or nasal spray, usually over the internet. Like other synthetic opioids, it's used for its heroin-like effects, but we don't know much about it. We don't really know how potent it is. Another analog or another synthetic opioid is AH7921. Now, this drug has opioid receptor activity. It's reportedly similar to morphine in its analgesic potency. It was first synthesized in 1962 in Great Britain, but it's never been marketed and it has no commercial or medical use. The DEA designated it a Schedule I drug on May 16, 2016, after being implicated and confirmed through lab testing in a number of overdoses and deaths that occurred in Europe and also here in the United States. U47700 is a synthetic opioid that in animal studies is 7.5 times more potent than morphine, but it's never been studied in humans. It was first discovered in the 1970s by the Upjohn Company, and it is a drug that's derived from the previous drug I mentioned, which was AH7921. It's currently not named as an illegal drug in the United States except in Ohio, but there's speculation that because it is an analog of AH7921 and that particular drug was recently controlled, that it might fall under a law that's called the Analog Enforcement Act And so it might be a controlled drug as well. But we don't really know for sure yet if it will come under that law or not. There has been a number of overdoses and deaths in the U.S. recently with U47700. Our poison center, in fact, has had at least two cases recently. MT45 is another synthetic opioid, and this was a drug that was first produced in the 1970s for research purposes. It was used in the development of other opioids. It has 80% the potency of morphine in animal studies. Recreational use of MT45 has been associated with hearing loss in three patients that were written up in the literature, and that hearing loss was reversible following discontinuation of the drug. And again, we're seeing overdoses and also some deaths that have been reported in Europe and also in the United States. Now, we suspect that synthetic opioids and fentanyl analogs will produce dependence with chronic use and adverse effects that are similar to the other opioids. If an overdose occurs, the clinical effects are likely to be just what you would expect with heroin. So you'd probably see lethargy, they may become unconscious, have respiratory depression, constricted pupils. Naloxone is expected to reverse the effects, as it did in our case, but we don't really know for sure if you really do need large doses like what was needed in our case. So maybe it's possible that doses greater than 2 milligrams might be required for some of these. We just don't know for sure yet. Typical hospital urine drug screens don't test specifically for fentanyl, for the fentanyl analogs or the other synthetic opioids, and they're not expected to produce a positive opiate assay when a patient their urine is tested for a tox screen. Another drug that I wanted to mention that's been in the news a lot lately is a drug called W18. Now, W18 is a synthetic drug, and it's been found in counterfeit tablets sold as fentanyl in Canada, and it has also been confiscated as a powder here in the United States. It's the most potent of a series of 32 analgesic compounds, and they're named W1 to W32, and they were developed at the University of Alberta in the 1980s. In animal studies, W18 has 10,000 times the analgesic potency as morphine. Now, that doesn't mean, though, that it's an opioid. Just because it has 10,000 times the analgesic potency as morphine, that doesn't mean that it's 10,000 times more potent than morphine as an opioid. So even though it's being reported in the news and in headlines that it's a potent opioid, little is really known about the pharmacology, and in fact, preliminary information suggests that it doesn't possess any activity at opioid receptors. In fact, it might only have effects on histamine 3 receptors. So we don't know much about the properties of the compound in humans. We don't know much about the toxicity, what to expect in overdoses. But even if it's not an opioid, it still can be quite toxic. It's currently not a federally controlled substance in the United States, but in Canada, where a confirmed death was recently reported, it was just made a controlled drug on June 1st. Now, it's important for poison centers to hear about cases like these so that we'll better know what to expect and how prevalent their use is. So I'd really like to ask everyone to report any suspected cases of overdoses with these drugs to your local poison control center. And the number for the poison centers in the United States is 800-222-1222.
And other than that last drug that you mentioned, do all the other opioids seem to respond, or the analogs seem to respond to naloxone, even if it takes multiple doses?
They do. There are cases where they have responded to naloxone. Really, there's not a lot out there. In the literature, there's very little information and case reports on any of these. And a number of them are fatalities where they couldn't be resuscitated at all. So, it just might have been too late for naloxone to work. So we really don't know for sure, but certainly with any of these, I would definitely give naloxone because there is a good chance that it will reverse the effects, and consider giving, if it doesn't work, give large doses, 2 milligrams or more, before you really rule out whether it's going to work or not.
Oh, it's good to know. And Lisa, this is important information. I'm going to make sure we get this out quickly on the show. And I'll look forward to having you back on in a future episode for some other Talks tidbits like this.
Thanks, Jamie. I'm sure there'll be something new that's coming out in months to come.
I'm sure.
First up in the special interviews I have from the NTI Critical Care Nurses Conference, I have clinical impact nurse Nancy De La Salle. She's here to talk about her program on getting ventilated patients mobilized a lot sooner in their critical care settings. Nancy hails from Long Island Jewish Medical Center in New Hyde Park, New York, and she and her team use the AACN's CSI Leadership Program to investigate ways to improve mobility of ventilated patients. Check it out. Hi, Jamie Davis here from the Nursing Show here at NTI 2016 in New Orleans, and we're talking all about the Clinical Scene Investigator Academy program, and I have Nancy De La Salle here to talk a little bit about your process and what you guys looked at in your facility. But before we get to that, can you tell us just a little bit about your background and why you wanted to become a nurse?
Sure. I've always wanted to be a nurse. I don't know why, but ever since I was little, I've always wanted to be a nurse. I've been a critical care nurse for 29 years. And to this day, still love it and still enjoy what I do.
Excellent. So you were a graduate of the Clinical Scene Investigator Academy, the CSI Academy that AACN puts on. Why don't you tell us about your experience and what spurred you to participate in the program?
We were given a grant from the CSI Academy. Our director asked four of us to join it. We already started a program for early mobilization. The CSI Academy helped us to facilitate and to give us the tools to help us to educate the nurses.
So when you look at this program and what you guys did, you looked at early mobilization, is that correct?
Yes, we started early mobilization with a vented patient, and with the tools that they gave us, we've actually have bridged out to every single patient that's been in the ICU. We started with just dangling at the bedside. We now get them up at the day one of being intubated and start walking them as soon as they meet certain criteria.
So what kind of patient outcomes did you see come out the other end of this when you started this program and really began implementing it?
There's definitely less vent days that the patients are there, and the length of stay in the ICU has gone down.
So that's significant, and not just for the patient as far as them individually, but as a cost savings to both them and the hospital. That really is significant, isn't it?
Yeah, it was a big savings. We estimated at the time, and it was proven that it saved us over $1 million in vent days in 6 months.
So as we kind of wrap up here, what advice do you give to some of those new nurses out there, or maybe a nurse that's looking at trying to work on developing their leadership skills? What advice would you give to them on the importance of cultivating leadership skills as a bedside nurse?
I think it's very important to have leadership skills. The CSI Academy is a great way to develop them. They give you the tools to do that. I would suggest to the nurses to see if they could join some of their evidence-based practice. If they have that in their hospital, join some of the associations. Start off with your local association.
Yep.
And then go to the American Association, the other associations, so they have the empowerment to do what they would like to do and the resources.
Well, Nancy, thank you so much for chatting with me. I really appreciate it. And I want to thank all of you for checking out this segment here from NTI 2016. Remember, all the segments that we've shot here are available for you over at the site, nursingshow.com. Next up is another CSI Leadership Program graduate, Laura Mills, whose catheter-associated UTI, or CAUTI, Hawks program had a significant effect on reducing these types of frequent infections in her facility at Swedish Medical Center in Seattle, Washington. Also, I want to remind you, don't forget to send a special thank you to our NTI 2016 overall sponsors, Physio-Control, who made the trip to this conference possible with their generous support of The Nursing Show. You can find out more about them at physio-control.com. Hi, Jamie Davis here from The Nursing Show at NTI 2016 in New Orleans. We're talking about the Clinical Scene Investigator Academy again and the CSI Academy program, which develops nurse leaders and empowers nurses to be game changers in their facilities. And I have Laura Mills here. So Laura, we're going to talk a little bit about your CSI Academy program here in just a sec, but I always like to start off asking the nurses that come on the show to tell us a little bit about their background and why they wanted to become a nurse.
Okay. Well, again, I'm Laura Mills, and I've been at Swedish Hospital, First Hill Campus in Seattle, Washington, for 25 years. It is the only place I've worked, and I absolutely love Swedish. And I have always wanted to be a nurse. That's all I can remember. And so I feel very honored to be in a profession that I feel is a calling for me. And there wasn't a significant event in my life that, you know, brought me to nursing. I just always wanted to be a nurse. And so I feel like I'm like that 0.001% that knew at a very young age, pursued my dream, and still after 25 years, I love doing my job.
So. That's awesome. So you're a graduate of the Clinical Scene Investigator Academy from AACN. Mm-hmm. Tell us a little bit about your participation in that program. What kind of got you started in it?
Well, we were selected by our CNS and the Critical Care Unit. And a group of four of us were selected and were part of this journey. It was a 16-month journey. And I had been working on CODIs for probably about 2 to 3 years prior to this. And we just brought this group together and decided that was what our project was going to be. So we thought it was a great opportunity for us professionally. And we really didn't know what we were getting into, to be perfectly honest. And but we were really happy with the journey that we had and the results.
So what did you find out when you started looking at these infections, you know, these catheter-associated UTIs that were in your facility? What did you find out? Were you surprised by some of the things you discovered as you started digging into it?
I was surprised. I think one thing that I think has been maybe a mistake in the past from hospitals is nurses really, I never had any idea prior to this experience or prior to starting to work as the infection NQL on our unit, what our CODI rate was, and or even like CLABSIs and VABs, mm-hmm. and things like that. The frontline nurse didn't have that information. And I think that's actually crucial for them because nurses want to do the right thing, but it's hard to know if you're doing something wrong if nobody ever speaks to you right. about that. And so I was surprised, I guess, at our infection, or actually I didn't really know. Is this an abnormal rate? Is right. this high? Are we really good or what's going on? But it's never good to have infections. So we knew we had some work to do.
You know, that's an interesting thing you say when you said you didn't know. I think that's one of the most common things I discover doing these types of interviews is that we really don't. The hospital doesn't publicize this kind of information, mm-hmm. but I think as caregivers at the bedside, it's imperative that we understand where our numbers are so that we can look at where we can improve and understand when the numbers get better that they did get better.
Right. I agree with you 100%. You don't know what to fix if you don't know there's a problem, right? So it's I was honored to work as an infection NQL and be asked by my managers to do that role. But it's, you know, again, I was starting at ground zero. And I learned a lot. It was really good for me because there was a lot of networking throughout the hospital and making connections and working with our data mm-hmm. people and quality improvement and epidemiology. So it's been a great journey.
So what did you find out? What did your team of four find out and implement in your facility? And what were some of the outcomes for the patients, the changes like?
So what we found out is we, despite our previous efforts, or my efforts, I guess, as the infection NQL, we are still above the national standard. And so we started out by taking a survey of the nurses and asking them what they thought the barrier was to catheter removal, surveying what their technique was for how they took care of patients' catheter, indwelling catheter. And you know, we kind of went from there. And we decided that, like I said, we'd been working on this, and people kind of had what we said CODI fatigue. But we really felt it was an important mission and that we had made steady gain, but not quite the results we wanted. So, you know, we just realized, well, we have to do a lot more education. Nurses are very intelligent. It's a great profession. And they're not going to just do something because you tell them to. You know, they want to know the why behind it. So, you know, we did a lot of research and article literature review. And that allowed us to kind of build a foundation for how we were going to educate our staff and help them come along on this journey.
So how did it affect things as you started this process? What kind of change did you see in outcomes for patients?
Well, we are very happy with our outcomes. Over the course of our 9 months, well, the whole journey of CSI was 16 months. But during our actual implementation, from the beginning to the end, we had a 92% reduction in our CAUTI rates, so which was great. You know, we did see a drop in our utilization of indwelling catheters, but I think it was really the importance of showing nurses that, you know, you can have them, but you know, we need to remove them as early as we possibly can. We can't just leave them in. And then if a patient's going to have an indwelling catheter, how do we best care for that? Mm-hmm. Because it is considered an invasive line. And how do we prevent our patients from getting an infection? You know, nobody wants to cause harm.
That's an amazing rate of change, though, and significant for a lot of patients not getting these infections.
It is, and you know, one of the things we kind of started with is asking nurses if he'd ever had a urinary tract infection and how did that feel, and you know, just so that they could kind of relate to that experience, and then just also talking to them about long-term consequences that predisposes patients to future, mm-hmm. you know, urinary tract infections. So we were proud of our nurses and our staff and our intensivists for all coming on board.
So as you look back at what you did with the CSI Academy, what's your takeaway? What do you take with you now every day that you learned in that process?
I think our biggest takeaway is that nurses have the power to create change, and working together as a group is huge. It's very hard to do something on your own, even though you might have the ideas and you're passionate about it. It's hard to sustain that. So working together as a group was significant in our change. And these are all frontline nurses who participated in the CSI. And I think showing our colleagues that we can do this as a group, that we have the ability to make change and provide better patient care and outcomes for our patients, was very inspiring.
Well, Laura, it's exciting to hear about what you guys are doing there at Swedish, and keep it up. That's great.
Thank you very much.
I want to thank all of you as well for checking out this segment here at NTI 2016. I'm Jamie Davis from The Nursing Show. Remember, you can find all the segments that we shot here, all these interviews, these fantastic stories, over at nursingshow.com. That's going to close out this week's episode of The Nursing Show. I want to thank all of you for checking out the program this week. Make sure you follow up, though, on all of the information you picked up in this episode. Head over to nursingshow.com and check out the episode show notes. There's a link right there at the top of the page. In there are listings for all of the episodes of The Nursing Show. From the most recent one at the top, you can scroll down and go all the way back to the very first episode. But I want you to get the full information there with links to other resources so that you understand how to apply what you hear on the show to your own nursing practice or studies. If you want to get back in touch with me, shoot me an email. You can send that in to nursingshow@gmail.com. I respond back to every email that comes in, and I want to hear from you. So send me your comments, your questions, suggestions, news links. Help support the Nursing Show community with your input. You can also get the Nursing Show email newsletter. There's a link and form right on the right-hand side of the Nursing Show site, so fill out that short form, and we'll send you the links to each episode's show notes directly to your email inbox each week. You can also connect with me on social media sites. I'm available there under the handle PodMedic, so you can find me there under twitter.com/PodMedic and facebook.com/PodMedic, so friend or follow me. You can also become a member of the community over on Facebook by liking the Nursing Show Facebook page at facebook.com/nursingshow. Click the like button there and join the conversation on that page. I post other nursing and healthcare articles and pictures on the Nursing Show site throughout the course of each week and over at the Nursing Show page, so check it all out. That's it for me. I'm your host, Jamie Davis. I'll be back with more episodes here of The Nursing Show. Remember, it comes out every Friday for you, so you can wrap up your nursing week. In the meantime, please remember to stay safe and stay tuned here to The Nursing Show.